Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
Welcome back to Chip Chat Live, recording from Supercomputing in Seattle, Washington. And my next guest is Arch Robison from Intel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Arch, you are a senior principal engineer at Intel, and you have a wide variety of achievements that I've been reading about. Lead developer for Kai C++, worked on an N-cube supercomputer at Shell. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your history in the space of enterprise computing and what you're working on today?
Yeah, I got started coming out of grad school working for Shell Oil, actually doing production processing on parallel computers, mm-hmm. which was unusual at the time because most shops were just doing research computing on with parallel machines. Mm-hmm. And Shell and actually some of the other oil companies, they're all very quiet about what they were doing, were running real production work on parallel computers. And in this case, it was a 256 processor hypercube.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the work at Intel, where is your focus on your team on parallelism, and how does that intersect with the challenges we're facing in the enterprise today?
We're primarily focused on not on getting the top efficiency out of the machine, which sounds horrible at a mm-hmm. place like this, but no, for the average user, sacrificing a little bit of performance for a lot of productivity is critical. So things like threading building blocks and the Silk Plus I work on, we try to make it easy for average programmers to use parallelism effectively, and I think it is usable with the systems we have.
You know, we've been talking about parallelism a lot at Chip Chat lately. We had James Reinders on talking about Silk a couple months ago at IDF. We also had some industry experts challenging the notion that parallelism can be made ubiquitous because of the complexities in parallelism. Obviously, if you're focusing your career on this particular pursuit, you probably don't agree with that opinion. But why don't I just begin with a question of why is parallelism so important as it relates to enterprise computing and the way our computer architectures have shifted over the last 5 years?
It's fairly simple. The number of transistors on the chip have continued to grow. It doubles about every 2 years or 1.5 years, depending upon how you count. But the clock rates, if you remember back in the 90s, every year it seemed like you could buy another 50 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And the clock rates went up and up and up. They got the 1 gigahertz, 2 gigahertz. And then if you remember back about 2005, you could buy 3 gigahertz machines. And now you can buy about 3 gigahertz machines.
Mm-hmm.
The clock rates have stopped going up. So you can't, out of a single processor, the clock rate effect, the faster the clock rate, the more a single processor can do. But now it's reached the limits, and it has to do with the underlying physics. The clock rates are just not going to go up much.
Right.
Unless you care to melt your lap. I mean, we can drive the chips much faster, but the heat output is phenomenal.
Right. Not very efficient.
So once you can, you've put a worker to work as hard as they can work, well, the thing is to do is to hire more workers. And so then it's just a matter of coordinating the workers.
And so we get into multi-core machines and multi-threaded machines.
Multi-core machines, multi-threaded, I should add also wider, so vector machines.
And so from a programming perspective, what are the challenges as we move into that space?
If you have multiple workers doing something, you have to orchestrate what they're doing sufficiently so that they don't stomp on each other's work. You have to coordinate their efforts. And you can't become top heavy on the management so that all your coordination efforts take more work than what the workers are doing.
Mm-hmm. I like your analogy. It reminds me of my team. so if you think about it that way, does it mean that there's a completely different approach to programming, or is it just some techniques that you have to employ to take advantage of that parallelism?
It's different. It's yes and no. When you're designing a program, it helps a lot to start thinking about it being parallel from the start. If you take a program and write it sequentially, or write it for sequential execution, and then after you're all done, you decide, oh gosh, now it's time to change it to parallel, you're going to have a tough time.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've made a bunch of decisions that may have affected whether it's easy to parallelize or not, pluses I like to point out is programs rise to the level of incompetence of their programmer. Mm-hmm. And by time, if you've written your sequential program, it's gotten complex enough, it's risen to the level of your incompetence. And this isn't an insult to programmers, it's just that if the program is not as complicated as you can make it, the competition will do it for you and outcompete you. So you're stuck in this Red Queen's race. But now the program is, you can barely understand what's going on with the sequential program. You don't have enough mental capital left to spend on the parallelization. So it's better to start early and get the parallelization built in before you reach this level.
So you can, I mean, I'm a marketing person, so I'm going to say something kind of blunt. You can slap it on at the end to make it work, but it's not going to be the elegant solution that's going to deliver the best result. Is that a correct way of thinking
right,
about
it? Right. It's something you can't slap on.
When you look at the fact that we're at supercomputing and we're looking at the HPC arena, there's a reason why we're having this conversation today. Why is parallelism founded in HPC and adopted in HPC much more readily than other segments of enterprise?
Because the HPC community wanted the highest performance at all times, and they couldn't wait for clock rates to increase. So, for example, when I was at Shell, the machines there sported a phenomenal 20 megahertz speed. And if 20 megahertz is the fastest you can make a chip go, well, you get more than one chip.
Right.
And so you harness, in that case, 256 chips together to get the work done.
So when we look at where we've gone, it's kind of going back to where we started, yet we're using cores and processors in combination to get there rather than a string of very low-performing processors.
Well, they're still, in a sense, they're still low-performing processors because they're much lower performing than the equivalent parallel machine.
Right, sure. When you look at the HPC industry, what do you think the key learnings are that this segment of enterprise computing has found in terms of delivering the creation of parallel capacity and parallel performance?
The high performance community and parallel community have found sets of parallel programming patterns that seem to work reasonably well and are fairly broad. For example, the simplest is just you hand out one piece of work to each worker and they don't communicate, and that's a very simple way to manage things. Mm-hmm. And then there's various means of so-called collective communications where the workers can communicate the results. Say the simplest is called a reduction, where you say sum up the result that each worker got.
Right.
And we understand fairly well how to implement those patterns efficiently across a large variety of hardware. So we've been certainly pushing programmers to think in terms of these higher level patterns and not just create a whole mess of threads and have them start sending messages to each other. And
I got started in our interview and had a lot of questions for you, so I forgot to mention that we're on live, and we've got an audience out there. Guys, if you want to send us your questions, please send them to our Blog Talk Radio site or at Twitter at Intel Chip Chat. We'll be taking a break in a few minutes and can get to those questions in the second half of the interview. You've described a way that the HPC community has utilized parallel computing effectively to drive to new levels of insight, which has been very important in the way our world has been shaped. I think where I've been getting to with conversations with experts at Intel and other folks in the enterprise space is that there seems to be this transition point that we're in the middle of, where the key learnings from this space are segueing into different areas of enterprise computing, and the opportunities for parallelism, that's a hard word to say, have been making inroads into other areas. Can you tell us a little bit about Intel's view on why that's important, and what are the things that your team are taking on to drive that?
Well, it's important because the chips we are selling have multiple cores, and the way to, and if you buy a multi-core chip but only program it using a single core, well, you've wasted most of what you've bought.
Right. And so that kind of defeats the point of a multi-core, multi-processor system.
Now, the good thing is that compared to with the high-performance computing machines, if you spend $1 million on a machine, you would like to get like 90% of the efficiency. So you could say, well, I'm only throwing away $100,000. Mm-hmm. Whereas at the very low-end machines, like a laptop, Well, you've already bought the machine, it's already paid for. And so if you only get, say, half the efficiency, that's mm-hmm. fine as long as it makes the program run faster.
Right. So when you look at something like TBB, I was reading about TBB. Can you describe to the audience what that is and why that's important in this broader context?
Yes. Threading building blocks started out about about 2005, and that's when we saw that multi-core processors were going to become common soon, but there weren't many programming tools for using those cores. There was, of course, something called OpenMP, but mm-hmm. OpenMP required a specially modified compiler and wasn't widely available on some of the key compilers that customers were using. And so we went about to create a C++ framework that sort of imitated actually some of these other parallel languages, but did it strictly as a library so it could just be compiled on any processor and work.
Mm-hmm. And what is the progress today, and where are we going with that?
Well, there seems to be there's a sort of a fork, and we seem to be taking both kinds of the fork. One is, threading building blocks continues to go in the direction of being a library-only solution. And technically, in fact, there was a paper written a couple of years ago by an expert pointing out how you can't write a parallel library using C++ without relying upon vendor extensions. Mm-hmm. And the paper is certainly correct. But the C++ 11 standard that was ratified last year, this is a new version of the C++ standard. It has all the necessary support for building a completely portable library for parallelism.
Mm-hmm.
The other tine of the fork is actually going after real compiler support. And this is the Silk Plus project I'm also working on.
Mm-hmm.
And in Silk Plus, we add some keywords to the compiler to let the programmer indicate what parts of the program may run in parallel. It doesn't say they have to run in parallel. It's just it gives permission to run in parallel.
Oh,
and that's critical. And then there's also the other part of that is that the plus part, which is key, some syntactic extensions for using the vector units on the processor. The vector units are things that instead of just adding 2 + 2 and getting 4, it can do, say, 8 copies of that problem in parallel.
Mm-hmm. When you look at these things, I was talking to James Reinders a couple months ago about Silk Plus, and there was a little glimmer in his eye about that project. Where is it that you guys think offers the biggest opportunity to drive parallelism across the ISV ecosystem ubiquitously? And where is the biggest opportunity in terms of markets or types of applications where this could really benefit?
I think it's for most applications. If the programmer's creative enough, they can find some application of parallelism. There's sometimes a tendency to say, oh, well, this is all parallel, and this market it's all inherently sequential. But I think that tends to be just looking at the old programs written for those markets, and sometimes not understanding how the problem may have changed since those programs were written.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, for example, parallelism, there's something known as Amdahl's Law that shows that basically parallel programming can't win if you assume you have a fixed size program and keep throwing processors at it. You find that there's a speed up limit,
mm-hmm.
and you can't go any faster than that. But what this law became famous in the 70s, and then in the late 80s, a guy named John Gustafson, actually now works for Intel, published a paper saying, well, at our national lab, we're running programs that are running 1,024 times faster than the serial program.
Wow.
So Amdahl's law saying there's a limit, no, something is wrong. And what it was is that we don't have fixed programs. The programs are handling bigger and bigger data sets as time goes on.
So is that, do you release a corollary to the law at that point?
There's something called Gustafson's law.
I love that. So, that we need to have a new law to take advantage of this. When you look at that, and we talk a lot about big data on this program and the growing data sets. Does this mean that parallel programming is a key to being able to pull the pearls of wisdom out of those big data sets and be able to do that on an efficient level? Or am I completely off track?
Well, it may be part of it. I think the other part is that, it's garbage in, garbage out. It's
mm-hmm.
figuring out algorithms that actually produce something meaningful out of those big data sets.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the progress that we've made thus far, you know, we've been talking about parallelism really since we made the right-hand turn to multi-core processors, and it seems like it's kind of a marathon of progress with the industry to adopt. Where do you think we are in the trajectory?
I think most shops realize now that if performance matters, and it doesn't always matter, I mean, that if it matters, that they have to go parallel, and they realize that there's a large variety of choices, and certainly Intel supports a bunch of those choices.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't answer my question, Arch. Where are we in that? You know, are we at the second mile? Are we at the 12th mile? Or, you know, are we almost at the finish line?
To me, it's always been happening, and it's the multi-core is just accelerated who needs to get involved. But I have a mathematical background. It's between zero and infinity, so I can't. It's just not well defined.
I'm not
going to
pin you down,
no.
Okay? Because it's constantly growing, kind of like the corollary or the new law that you just talked about. All right, we are going to go to a break, and we will be back with more information about parallel processing with Arch. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
We'll be right back with more of Allison's interview. Have a question? Visit us at twitter.com/IntelChipChat. We'll be answering questions live next.
Welcome back to Chip Chat, live from beautiful Seattle, Washington. I'm with Arch Robison from Intel. We've been having a conversation about parallel computing, which is making my head spin. I had a note that said that Intel just won an award from HPC Wire. Editor's Choice for Best HPC Software Product for Intel Parallel Studio XE 2011. That's exciting.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Because, yeah, so projects I've been working on and a lot of my coworkers in the office have been working on for years. It's
so that,
being recognized.
Congratulations on that. But why don't you tell us about Parallel Studio XE and why you think it was selected as something that was the Editor's Choice? What is so notable about it?
It is a there's two parts. One is it plugs into Visual Studio that everyone uses, at least on Windows.
Mm-hmm.
The other part, and our version's available for Linux. The other part is it's a comprehensive suite of what you need to program a multi-core machine easily and efficiently.
And
it doesn't just force you down one particular path. It has threading building blocks. It has Silk Plus. It has OpenMP.
When you look at that, what has been the success of that product in terms of addressing different customer requirements for parallelism? Where do you see software vendors taking it in terms of uptake?
I'm not sure. Yeah, specifics.
Mm-hmm.
But we see it as the suite comes with all the tools they need to figure out where the parallelism is in existing code if they broke the first rule I discussed earlier, which is design the parallelism from the scratch.
Right.
And then it has ways to express a couple different ways to express parallelism. And then it has the tool. The key part is you're still not done yet if you write a parallel program.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to debug it and find the places where, say, workers stomped on each other's work by not correctly sequencing stuff, like two hands reached into the cookie jar at the same time and got jammed.
Right.
And then the final part is the performance. Is once you got debugged and correct, you can still, there's some performance traps, and we have tools in the suite to let the programmer analyze how their program's running and find the gotchas there.
When you look at, you had talked about a client implementation of parallelism. When you look at enterprise, obviously parallelism is a goal of increased performance in some contexts. I think that's where the mind naturally goes. But when you look at parallelism in a world where, you know, you've got, you know, billions of devices across the planet also maybe benefiting from parallelism, what is the drive and desire there, and what are the primary benefits that the user will experience?
There's people sometimes debate whether it's, they talk about throughput versus response time, but in the end, it's usually response time at some level.
Can you give an example of,
well,
of why that
would
be?
Well, common one is, say, Google queries.
Mm-hmm.
When you type in a query to Google, it goes into their server farm, along with everyone, lots of other queries at the same time, and somehow that it, all those processes are somehow working in parallel, and that's a, it's both easy and difficult is what they do. You get the answer faster than, say, if everybody's queries had to line up and go through one little machine. You might actually might wait a long time to get your answers.
Yeah, that's very true. And there's a lot of people querying at the same time. When you look at the different products that we have out, if we have a person in the audience that's interested in learning more about how to utilize them and how to put them into practice in terms of their own coding, what do you think would be a good place to start? And where do you think you would suggest folks to look at different types of applications that we are offering, different tools that we're offering, based on the types of applications that they're working on?
One place to look, well, for specific tools, we have like Threading Building Blocks. It has a website, threadingbuildingblocks.org, that we run. And it has documentation that includes like a design patterns manual. It just has, like, each chapter is a separate design, a pattern, and then how to implement the pattern in Threading Building Blocks. Though in some cases, the programmer may see the pattern. Once they understand the pattern, they may see how to implement it with other frameworks, too. Silk Plus, likewise, we have a silkplus.org site for items related to Silk Plus. And there's a lot, because Silk comes from an MIT research project of about 15 years ago, there's a lot of online materials about the theory of Silk. The race detect. Now, I said we also have tools for debugging and so-called race detection and memory error checking. Those I really can't point to. There's some online materials, but they don't like have their own websites like the Threading Building Blocks and the Silk Plus.
When you and your team get together to discuss the next wave of challenges, you know, I know that principal engineers at Intel tend to not be satisfied with what we're doing today. Where do you think our next wave of challenges is in terms of parallelism, and what are the things that make you excited to come to work every day in terms of the next big problem to solve? Is it education of the industry and getting them to use current tools?
I think that certainly the education is seems to be the big one. In fact, that's why I was here earlier in the week doing a tutorial at Supercomputing on using threading building blocks and Silk Plus and array building blocks, which is another framework that Intel offers. And the other part, I'm also working with some other people at Intel on a book on parallel programming and approaching it as from not just here's our tools and how to use them, but here's general ways to think about parallel programming and for concrete examples, here's how you write it in our particular framework. But we're largely pushing this higher level thing. Here's patterns that work. In fact, we call the book Structured Parallel Programming.
When you go to universities today and you look at how computer science is being taught, are students being taught from the beginning to think in parallelism?
I think it's understood that they should be. Whether that's happening yet is not clear.
Because it seems like, from a mental model perspective, that kind of needs to happen to shift a software design concept to I'm always going to be writing with parallelism in mind rather than this is the way I do things and now I have to introduce parallelism.
Well, in fact, it's more so than a lot of cases the students actually, they come from a background, just ordinary life where lots of things do happen in parallel.
Right.
And then they get this serial mindset drilled into them the first year of freshman programming. And then we're asking to undo that. So if we'd stop drilling that in from the start, they'd be way ahead. For example, my kids, they would write parallel programs from scratch. I mean, these are when they were grade schoolers, using things like, the Smalltalk derivative.
I know what you're talking about. And so you're saying that parallel programming is more of a natural mindset that we've gotten away from in our early years of computing because it wasn't, the models didn't support it.
The hardware didn't support it, and in fact, in some ways, still if you want very fast execution on a single core, it's still sequential codes are still the best thing around. I mean, in the 90s, mm-hmm. people, in the 80s and 90s, people experimented with these like single cores that were naturally parallel, called these data flow machines that did everything possible in parallel, and the serial cores beat them out in the end. Because if you know what you're going to do next and have an ordered list, very carefully ordered list, you can do a lot of planning around that for efficient execution.
You know, and maybe that's the good last topic for this interview, which is, you know, we've talked a lot about some workloads work better in a serial nature. Some workloads today work better being parallelized and are more suitable to being parallelized. Do you think that's because of the way the work actually needs to be done, or just in the way that that particular area has been evolved, if you will, in terms of the way they approach solving problems? And is anything really open to parallelism?
I think there may be a few things, you know, exceptions that prove the rule, they're inherently sequential. Mm-hmm. But most of them, you can find some parallelism. And if you can't within the program, within the workload, well, run two of them.
Right.
Which, of course, academics dismiss it with the term embarrassingly parallel. But mm-hmm. if it works, why not do it?
So is it still back to your analogy of work distribution? You could still distribute work amongst multiple players, but maybe not get the synergies and efficiencies of some other workloads. But still, parallelism might make sense.
Right. It's still, as far as distributing, in fact, I often say that if you can get speed up proportional to the square root of the number of processors, you've actually matched what the architects would have done on a single processor anyway, mm-hmm. as far as power and transistor budgets.
So if education large ubiquity of usage is the primary challenge. You know, when you guys get together and debate the next wave of technology innovation in this space, are there any areas which are known as opportunities for the next area for development? Is there controversy in which way we should go in this space, or anything that your team spends a lot of time debating and discussing?
I think the debate's actually not what to add, it's what to remove.
Oh, interesting.
You can make things easier on a user if you remove features, if you take them away and make other features, make things either automatic or other features cover the cases that you thought you needed two features for.
So simplification and automation are the focus points?
Automation to a point. There's always this tension between who can do a better job of some particular aspect of the programming. Can the mm-hmm. system do it better, or can the programmer do it better? And there's a tension there as to who to put the burden on.
Mm-hmm.
And often, particularly threading building blocks, the usual rule is, like a lot of good C++ programming is, we take on the burden unless we can't figure out how to do it, and then we push it on the user.
Interesting. So, Arch, you know, it's been an interesting conversation. Obviously, you guys are working on things that are so incredibly important for the computing industry as a whole. The ability to program as efficiently and effectively as possible on the underlying architecture forms the capabilities of our computing systems moving forward. You know, we got a question from the audience about what you've seen at supercomputing that excited you the most, but I know you haven't seen anything yet because you came here. What are you excited about this week to see? And we'll leave the interview with that question. What is exciting to you about engaging with the high-performance computing industry this week?
Oh, to see what new machines are out there and what new ideas. I guess I always look for the strange stuff. I'm just harnessing a whole bunch of the old processors. It's like, yeah, it might be interesting. But if there's some new kind of interconnect or new kind of software to harness them up, simply ganging them up, making something just bigger is not that interesting. But often supercomputing, there's some interesting machines out there.
I think that it's always an interesting group to go walk around in, because you find the most quirky solutions to solving problems compared to other areas of our industry. And I think mostly a lot more freedom in sharing of ideas in this space, which I find really refreshing. If people want to contact you and learn more about what you and your team are doing, where can they find you?
Easiest way for me is email. Mm-hmm. It's just arch.robison@intel.com.
Mm-hmm.
Like most people, I'm first name dot last name. And or the Threading Building Blocks has a forum. If you just Google Threading Building Blocks forum, there's, you can post questions there. And likewise, Silk Plus has a forum for posting questions.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm sure that our audience learned as much as I did about parallel programming and what the team at Intel is doing to help drive that across the industry. Have a great week at Supercomputing.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thanks very much.